said at the beginning, if you could join us, your entry was well timed. We'll take up House Bill number 358.
Where is my bill?
If you could just take it, that'd be fine.
I'll take it.
We have an attendance, Representative Iden, Representative Parnell, Representative Donnelly, Representative Finkelstein. When we last visited House Bill 358, it and House Bill 414 were still before us. We have a CS dated 2/12/92, which all the members should have. We're really, really crunched for time today. We've got to get four bills done before in 40 minutes. So if you could, as quickly as you could, just tell us the differences, and we'll, there, Representative Donnelly.
Motion to adopt CS for purposes of discussion?
Sure. So moved. Representative Donnelly, any objection to adopting the CS dated February 12th? Hearing none, stop it. The floor is yours, Representative Beasley.
Well, the CS, Mr. Chairman, takes out the change that I had originally in the Board of ASME, which I still believe is a good change, and that I'd be willing to take it out of this bill, and I will at some time in the future make a motion for amendment in another bill that deals with ASME to still pursue that change. But this, the bill as it is now, would just set up the a seafood marketing educational program within the University of Alaska Marine Advisory Program. And as I understand it, you have introduced a bill today that would address the funding also of this program. And
we do. We have that bill, which was introduced today as a committee bill, to come to course next week. It's an outcome of all the process on this bill. Any questions for Representative Kubina? The next bill before us will be House Bill 14, which takes up the ASME board changes. Any further discussion on this bill? Is there a motion on this bill, Representative
Donnelly?
Is there objection from the members? Hearing none, so adopted. Thank you.
Thanks for your work on this, Mr. Chairman.
Nate, did you want to join us? You can just identify yourself for the record and tell us briefly the changes in House Bill 414.
For the record, my name is Landa Holton. I work for Representative Bill Hudson. The original Bill 414 is vastly different from the proposed committee substitute that you have before you, 414. This legislation would change the ASME board to include two members of the fishing harvesters. To ASME, it would change the quorum from 10 to 12. The current statute is silent in relation to the makeup of executive board on ASME, and this legislation addresses the makeup of an executive board, and it would require at least two members on the executive board who are engaged in fishing. And there's language on page 3 as a section stating that if there is an assessment for marketing collected, that there would be a subcommittee within ASME composed of 7 people, 4 fishing harvesters, and 3 ASME board members. The subcommittee, who would be making the decisions on how to spend the assessment, their decisions could not be overruled unless 3/4 of the ASME board voted to overrule that decision. It provides for a collection of an assessment, a 1%. It's my understanding that the many different individual member groups of the United Fishermen of Alaska have not had a chance to take this legislation back to their individual members, and it's just a vehicle to get things on the table and discussed and hopefully do something with the digital marketing aspect to facing the site.
Thank you. This is essentially the same as what we had before us last week, the February 4th version.
Yes.
Any questions for Linda? Thank you for joining us.
Just an answer.
Oh, Representative Brown?
Might relate to Representative Hudson when he gets back from being sick, that I'd like to talk to him about that last point that you just made regarding the voting composition and the numbers it takes. I need to know what's special that makes that dynamic necessary.
Representative Donnelly.
Move to adopt the CS.
We move to adopt the February 12th CS. Is there objection to adopting the February 12th CS? Hearing none, so adopted. Any further discussion on House Bill number 414? Any motion, Representative Donnelly?
Move the bill with individual recommendations.
Is there objection to moving the bill with individual recommendations? Hearing none, so ordered. We're now to House Bill 297, Insurance Coverage for Adopted Children. We have the sponsor with us today, Representative Donnelly. It's sponsored by the committee. But is there any comments you wanted to offer at this time?
It's real simple.
We have a department here as well.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's real simple bill. It would extend insurance coverage to adopted children. Frequently, they're not covered in health insurance policies, and they're also exempted from pre-existing conditions. And we just had some series of requests from folks that this was something that would be just really fair proposal to do, as the state tries to encourage adoption of children also. And so we suggested to the chair that the committee sponsors such legislation.
Representative Brown.
Just a question. Is this for our children that the couple wish to adopt that have not been born, or are these for children that have been born that any defect minority? Does it distinguish between the two?
You can't adopt somebody until they're born. So, but it applies to all adopted children.
So then it wouldn't be if the parents actually might have that child that's after.
For pre-existing conditions, a lot of policies will have 1 year. This would say that they would be covered the same as other children, so there wouldn't be a distinction between adopted and non-adopted.
Any other questions, Representative Donnelly? We've got time to test by Don Cope. Don, please join us.
Thanks. For the record, my name is Don Cope, with the Division of Insurance. The Division supports this legislation. The Newborn Children Bill, which this is an extension of, was one of the very few health insurance mandates, if we'll do it that way, that the Division has supported over the years. There have been some minor modifications to that, but that's generally our view. We view this Newborn Children piece of legislation as an anti-discrimination feature. It's a logical extension to take adopted children and put them in the same category as the newborn children. Interestingly enough, this still leaves a hole that you may wish to consider. And that is and this is an issue, by the way, that our consumer complaint staff came up with during the summer as we were deliberating on the monster that folks unfortunately have moved on. Single persons cannot go out and buy family coverage unless they already have family. So if you have newborn children born to a single person or a single person who is adopting children, they're going to be subject to the usual pre-existing conditions exclusions. And those can run anywhere from 6 months to a year, which is a long time to leave an infant or a child without any coverage. And it certainly does deter the adoption of children as far as the adoption end of it goes. There are many people now who have no desire to be married but wish to have children. This puts those folks in the same kind of boat. So for their planning purposes, this would be something that you may wish to consider. The idea is that you would mandate the offer of family coverage to anybody, whether they be single or married. And we have some conceptual language that we provided to the committee, but I'm not overly enamored with how well that is structured. I think in concept, though, it's a good idea to further extend this. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to assist the chair.
Representative Parnell.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I just simply am interested in knowing how the industry handles that child as far as canceling parents' insurance, whether a child, and all of a sudden they find they have this enormous costs, maybe for life. Probably on that one, they would be required to cover it for life, but then can they bail out and not cover the family, thinking that other medicals might come up?
The answer is yes, they can. There is no restriction on the health insurer from canceling its coverages. Once the incident occurs that is covered under the policy, that incident is going to be covered to its logical conclusion, whatever, you know, whatever that happens to be. But the insurer can, in fact, get off the coverage. There's no barrier.
So then the prospective parent or parents need to wait, evaluate adopting a child with the potential of losing their insurance once the company is required to pay for the child they're going to adopt.
That's true.
Depending on the magnitude of the difficulty the child has endured at birth.
I understand your point. Through the chair, I think you have an equally burdensome problem with naturally born children. I mean, children that are born to natural parents. There's no guarantee how that's going to come out either. So you do have, and yes, this is a potential burden on insurers.
Let me pursue that for a minute.
Sure.
Could there be, and would it be a wiser approach to use an option for parents to move into that so that they're not confronted with an either-or situation, but if they feel they can financially afford just difficulty themselves more than they can afford to lose their insurance covering their family, they'd have an option not to submit it?
Through the chair, that's already an option. You can purchase your insurance coverage and structure it pretty much the way you wish to. And if you wish to exclude an adopted child because you know that there's going to be other difficulties that the insurer is apt to cancel you for, you can do that.
Maybe I misunderstood the bill. I thought it was mandatory that the child be covered.
Offered.
It's
a mandatory offering.
You're correct. It's a mandatory. They must mandatorily provide it, but I don't see that there's a problem
I guess the point is that the coverage is for adopted children is the same as for natural children. I guess your point is that you have the option with natural children to exclude one.
Yes.
So you have that option to exclude one as an adopted child as well.
But I understand Mr. Parnell's point. The language in the existing statute is such that option may not be there.
Could you check that for us?
I will.
Representative Rucker.
You always certainly have the option of not turning in the bill, too. Not giving insurance money to the bill for whatever reasons you may have. My concern, I heard you said, you use the word discriminatory, and I agree. I think this is essentially good legislation. But if we're covering pre-existing conditions for adopted children, and not specifying what age that child is adopted at, because that could certainly be a wide range, and I'm pleased you did limit it to ages, but we're not extending the same benefits to children born or living with their natural parents. Insurance companies will use their switch companies, et cetera, will not allow pre-existing conditions. And I'm a little confused on how that.
The pre-existing, you're correct, the pre-existing condition issue is I think one of the big thorns in the side of the health insurance industry today, and I do know that there are some bills in the legislature, I'm not sure if there's a House version right now, that attempts to address that issue.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being that once you have gone through a pre-existing condition and you have to switch carriers through no fault of your own, or because you are being employed someplace else with a different plan, or your current employer loses his coverage and has to go someplace else, that you don't have to again go through a pre-existing condition. And I see that as a train coming down the tracks quick, and the insurers are not going to be able to duck it too much longer. And in fact, they've come forward with a proposal that basically provides for one pre-existing condition in the lifetime of a covered person, the object being that person continues coverage somewhere. And I think that's a good idea. But you're correct about this with children, and that is, since that doesn't currently exist, indeed, if coverage has to change to another carrier, or for any of those reasons I stated, they have to go into, they have a pre-existing condition clause in there that will bar coverage for certain things for a period of time. And I think that's a sad scene, and I've seen it happen a number of times. There's a lot of people who end up considered uninsurable because of that. So there's money coming from those folks that are not going into the system. It's just, you're right.
Okay, and I what I'm feeling though is this isn't the place to fix that.
I mean,
right.
I would say not. This,
right.
I don't believe this one's nearly.
Hopefully, it's.
Yeah. Any other questions for Donna? Thank you, John, for joining us. We also have with us Tom Bergstrom from the Department of Health and Social Services, Mike Poplin, Retirement and Benefits. Anyone have any questions they wish to ask them?
Yeah. For the record, my name is Tom Bergstrom, Department of Health and Social Services. I might be able to shed a little bit of light on the question from Representative Harnell. We don't do a lot of adoptions, but many of the adoptions that we participate in are for children who are in our custody who are medically complex, very expensive kids, and we have about 14 or 15 of them who have been placed in adoptive families. When that adoption is made, we pay all medical bills for that child in the future. So in the instance of very expensive children, I would anticipate that our program would continue to pay their medical expenses rather than being thrown on the parents' insurance policy and perhaps having them canceled. So for that class of children, they would be covered. And that's for the, as I say, very, very expensive children. We pay that with 100% general funds, and we do have another bill coming along shortly that will pick up that service is offered as a Medicaid option. And so we have legislation in which will take that Medicaid option, and at that point, $325,000 a year that we spend on that program, all general funds, will become a 50-50 match. And unlike a lot of the Medicaid options that you hear about that save money in the long run and never quite do, this one actually does. And,
great.
Yeah, if that helps at all.
Thanks, Representative Farnell. Thank
you. Just probably to digress, but does a person who today is incapacitated and gets Medicaid benefits and is uninsurable for other conditions that are totally unrelated to the present difficulty. Does the bill you're bringing forward address that?
No, it only addresses the adoptions. And just for that class of approximately 15.
Is this other area that I just described something that will be in the Senate Adoptions Bill?
Yes, I believe it is.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. Reed Stoops is here, who represents Aetna. If anyone has any questions for him as well, he'd be glad to answer. Did you want to offer some testimony here?
No, Mr. Chairman. My name is Reed Stoops. I'm here on behalf of Aetna to answer any questions. We supplied the information to Department of Administration for the fiscal note, and because of the low fiscal impact, at this point, at least the bill is currently drafted. I don't think we have any major problems with it, but certainly glad to answer any questions. It seems to us it's mainly it's a policy call that the legislature made.
Great. Thank you, Reed. Any further discussion from the committee? Representative Brockman.
Question, and it is really doesn't pertain. On page 2, the language on the language is placed for adoption. Is it generally very time consuming? Does it take a long time for an adoption to be finalized? And generally during that period, does the child stay with the potential parents?
We could
It doesn't matter who when a child is placed for, or a child placed for adoption, at what point does the child become placed for adoption? Does a parent, a person apply?
Joan, did you want to provide an answer?
Okay.
Sure.
Do
you to identify yourself.
Joan Knuckles, Statute Representative Donnelly, through the Chair, Representative Bruckman. The period to which we're talking about, the length of the placement of adoption, lasts anywhere from 60 to 120 days. And I'm conferring with both a Juneau attorney and an Anchorage attorney on this matter. So we're talking about a limited length of time.
So the words placed for adoption doesn't mean that the child is available for adoption. It means that someone that has applied to, right, to adopt that particular child.
And at that point, the child can be brought into the home.
That's what, okay, good.
Thank you. Any further discussion? We, if people have any remaining concerns, we could hold over to next week, or we could act on it now. What's the preference of the committee? Mm-hmm. Representative Bruckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that we pass the individual recommendations.
Is there an objection to passing out the individual recommendations? Hearing none. So, John, the final bill before us today is Senate Bill 349. Judy, if you could join us, we bring along, since we're going to bill nobody suggested any amendments. Judy, if you could identify yourself and offer your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Judy Knight, and I am Director of the Employment Security Division in the Department of Labor. Senate Bill 349, amended, does provide authority to the department to, in this particular instance, at this particular time, it allowed us to implement the Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program that Congress finally got the President to sign in mid-November. Congress had passed two previous bills, which the President had vetoed, and the Emergency Unemployment Compensation provided 20 additional weeks of unemployment benefits to the many thousands, millions of people across the country who had been unemployed a long time and who had exhausted their regular benefits. As you know, Mr. Chairman, we have an extended benefit program in Alaska law that is the same nationwide. That extended benefit program did not meet the needs and was not addressing many of the unemployed workers in the lower 48 because so many people were exhausting their benefits before those eligibility criteria could kick in to allow them to pay extended benefits. In Alaska, we have a little bit different situation because most of our unemployment is in the winter months, so that we do trigger onto extended benefits, which provide additional weeks when you have high unemployment. The reason we wanted to implement the special emergency unemployment compensation program was because it did provide either 16, 18, or 20 weeks of benefits to our claimants in addition to their regular benefits, whereas extended benefits would have only provided somewhere between 8 and 13 weeks. So it almost doubled the number of weeks that claimants in Alaska would be eligible to receive. I think it sort of slipped up on us that our economy is not as good as we would like to think it is. Our unemployment rate for December was 10.1%, ranging from a low of 3% in the Aleutians, which we know doesn't represent true unemployment because so many people don't look for work, to a high in Haines of over 18%. We expect that unemployment rate in Alaska to climb throughout January, February, and March. Right now, I have over 50,000 claimants drawing at this time. Unfortunately, I have stacks of claims on the floor. We have been working 6 and 7 days a week, 10 and 12 hour days since mid-November to implement this special program and to get benefits out as quickly as possible. We are close to catching up. I had over 6,000 new claims in January. And to give you a comparison, in 1990, we only paid unemployment insurance benefits in the total calendar year to 40,000 people, never 50,000 at one time. So that's a significant increase. As I say, our economy is not that good, and if you talk to most economists in the state, they don't expect real dramatic changes. Certainly, we have a seasonal economy, and we'll see a lot of people go back to work in the spring and summer. but we have people who are drawing benefits today, and I could tell you stories from now until morning about some of the frustrations, the sheer desperation of some people in the state, many whom of whom have not worked since 1990. They did not work at all in calendar year 1991. So that brings us to why we're here today. We did, by emergency regulation, notwithstanding the existing statutes, adopt and implement this federal unemployment emergency unemployment compensation program. And this bill today is here to say the attorneys weren't quite sure that we had the legal authority to bypass those statutes that say we will have an extended benefit program, to make those regulations permanent. However it should be worded, I know the Senate was a little concerned. We don't want to give the department too much authority. We want to make sure that this is going to be to the benefit of people who need it. And so certainly they significantly tighten up the bill. I have no problem with those changes. I understand there's some concern on the House side, because I know this committee, this bill has a number of referrals. I'm interested in two things. I have more work and more workload than my staff can handle. We have hired additional people, but there is a 3 to 6 month learning curve before people can really process claims. So at a point you reach, how many people can you hire and make it productive? I feel like I've reached that level, and yet we're still behind and people still need their money. That's one issue. The other issue is, if we don't have a bill passed and signed into law before the emergency regulation expires in early April, that means I have to trigger on to extended benefits, and that is a paper processing nightmare. It means I have to get a new application for everybody who is on emergency unemployment compensation and say we're going to transfer you from this program to that program, and I estimate that to be between 10 and 15,000 people by the time April comes. And we don't have the staff to process it. It means an interruption in their benefits. And I'm concerned about that simply because I don't have the staff to deal with it and maintain timely payments to claimants. So that's why we're here before you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. I believe in your packet, I know I've thrown out a lot of terms to you and it gets confusing, but I hope that all of you have this piece of paper, and that helps you a little bit understand between regular benefits and extended benefits and emergency benefits.
Can I ask a couple of questions? Representative Donnelly, number one, why does it say notwithstanding AS 2323-409?
When the bill was originally written, Senator Donnelly and Mr. Chairman, it was notwithstanding this chapter. And
I think I have it memorized.
Anyway, it was tightened up just to refer to the benefits section. And why, I'm sure you have your next question is, why does it need to be that broad? Congress is working on two pieces of legislation currently, and I expect both of those, or some semblance of one of them, to pass to say that something else is going to have to be done for the large number of unemployed. What that will look like, I don't know. In my mind, it could go anything from a difference in eligibility to saying, well, we only have X amount of federal dollars, so let's extend people's benefits. You've already drawn your regular benefits of up to 26 weeks. You've already drawn emergency benefits of 20 more weeks. Let's give you 13 more weeks or 10 more weeks at only half your benefit amount. That could be a scenario that Congress plays out. Whatever that scenario is, I would think we would need to look at it very carefully and make sure that it benefited our claimants and that it didn't put a drain on the trust fund. The good thing about the emergency unemployment compensation was that it is paid for 100% with federal funds. We don't have to take money out of the trust fund.
So the reason, you said the only part of that that was relevant to those sections was that it wasn't in the original bill, it was added by the Senate?
the original bill said notwithstanding this chapter, meaning AS 2320. The Senate, working with legal counsel, reduced that to only the benefit sections. The one part in our law that's very obvious that we would have had to notwithstand is it says when the insured unemployment rate reaches 6%, you shall be in extended benefits and shall pay benefits accordingly. That's AS 2320-409. You know, we could go through section by section, and I could give you the attorney's reasoning behind saying that we need this broader span of statute.
The next question I've got is this section 3 in line 11, 12, 13?
Mm-hmm.
Would that allow a commissioner alone to reduce the amount of benefits for individuals?
Mr. Chairman, not in my mind at all.
Okay.
So I think there are, you have to look at 1, 2, and 3, and 4 all in the same context, that all four conditions have to be met. And I can't imagine the Secretary of Labor authorizing a program that's going to reduce benefits in every state. I don't think our political process would stand for that.
Representative Parnell?
I'd look to see what kind of projection that you felt money-wise this would bring in the state to help. Do you have something like that? How many dollars?
We estimate a savings to the, when the bill was drafted, we estimated a savings to the trust fund, the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund in Alaska, between $3.5 and $7.5 million. Making a revised estimate, I would raise that to approximately $10.5 million. The first 9 weeks of the program, we paid over about 7,200 individuals $5.5 million. So estimating that this is going to go to June 13th, I would say the total program we're going to bring in about $40 million.
Maybe because I'm not real familiar with this, Mr. Chairman, but is that as a result of this Senate amendment?
I think there's a part of they already did issue the regulations. This just reestablishes its authority. If there's any doubt, we're already doing it. So.
Senate amendment made sure that no money came out of the general fund, is that right?
I think the Senate amendment was saying only under these conditions could you do something like you have already done. And yes, it does make it more restrictive. We have no problem with any of the amendments the Senate made. First of all of the administrative dollars for unemployment insurance are federal dollars, which are appropriated through the state budget process. You know, and if we don't have enough authorization to spend those federal dollars, then we go to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee if it's interim and asked for additional authority. We have additional federal revenues, and this is the reason why. We have done that a number of times over the last 15, 20 years. In recent years, no, because our economy has been very good. So that's the administrative side of the dollars. On the dollars that are actually paid out in benefits, we write a check to an individual who is unemployed. That money is drawn down through the interstate banking agreements, and as we issue payments to individuals, we send a telegraph thing back to Washington, D.C. and draw federal funds out of their money to reimburse our Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. So all of the money is federal.
Any other questions for Judy?
I'm somewhat concerned about the language on page 113 where it says it will produce a net monetary gain to the state and its people. At first blush, I thought that, you know, yes, unemployment, this would produce a gain to the state and its people, but it sounds to me like it's limiting the state to avail itself of this program unless we not just break even, but actually see a net monetary gain, in other words, dollars on the plus column. And it doesn't say break even. So I'm somewhat concerned that we could not implement the program if it cost us a dollar more.
I hear what you're
saying. Yeah, I hear what I'm saying, technically.
But I think I don't have any problem with this very tight language. almost any circumstance is going to produce a net monetary gain to the state. I receive my unemployment insurance administrative dollars based on my workload. I get paid $14.50 for every new claim. I get paid $10.20, I don't know what it is, I'm making these numbers up, but that's an example. Mm-hmm. It's based on workload. It's a piecemeal type thing. If I have 5,000 new claims, I'm gonna get that many dollars to spend. Mm-hmm. If I have so many appeals, so many ongoing payments every week, I get so many dollars to spend. Anytime we have high unemployment, mm-hmm. it naturally generates more workload and more dollars.
So you're but you're paying out? That's costing money too, isn't it?
But it's not costing the state anything.
It does, okay.
All of these monies are coming from Washington, D.C.
Okay, even though you need to hire more people.
Still doesn't cost the state of Alaska any money.
The state of Alaska isn't paying the salary.
It's gonna be reimbursed by federal
dollars. More than we, okay, always more.
There's never any general funds in unemployment insurance.
I guess that's just hard to believe.
The dollars are net gain.
Yeah, it's, are there other programs we could apply for?
We should have more, right?
Right. What if, if they change their rules and it suddenly wasn't a gain, I'd hate to lose the door.
If they change their rules and it wasn't a gain, I don't think under this section of law that the Department of Labor would have the authority to do that. That needs to come before the legislature and make a decision. Do we want to adopt this federal program or do we not want to adopt it? And I'm very comfortable with the constraint put on there. I don't think you want to, as the Senate said, we don't want you to eliminate the need for the legislature. Don't take away our authority. But where it is where, I anticipate that Congress will probably not do anything until this emergency expires in late June. Mm-hmm. That's the only impetus they know to get a bill moving. And so where are you in June when it may benefit our state?
Okay.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this giving you a permanent okay to spend future federal dollars as they become needed in the future?
Yes and no. First of all, I can't spend any federal dollars that aren't appropriated in the budget process. When you pass the Department of Labor's budget, there are funds in there, in personal services and on down the line, that say, and we base that on the number of claims. Each year we project the number of claims we think we're going to have. And then I put in a little cushion, in case we put a plus or minus 10%, and we look at that scenario. We have to estimate those, and those go into the big pie in the sky in Washington, D.C., and the Congress appropriates the money based on this estimate. And so you would have to appropriate those federal dollars in my budget process. If I don't have enough, if I got more money than I had the authority to spend, then I have to come back to you.
Would it be appropriate to ask Mr. Chairman if you could give us your projected figures, like on one sheet, on what you, there's $40 million and you're 10.5, and just kind of give us another information sheet like you did on how it works.
Okay.
What it is we're going to see.
I can give you some updated numbers as to how many people are on emergency unemployment compensation.
Your projection.
I'll be glad to do that.
Yeah, that'd be very, very important.
Representative Ivan, did you have a question?
No, I didn't have any questions. In other words, we would be holding it for further information.
Well, do you have an interest in holding it?
I don't.
No. Yeah, I don't.
I think it would just be information you could provide.
I can give that back to you and Catherine, or I can distribute to individually.
Great. Representative Parnell has moved the bill with individual recommendations. Is there any objection? Mm-hmm. Hearing none, so ordered. Any other business before the committee?
Thank you.
And we're adjourned.
Does it put money into our economy? It allows the grocery store, all of these things in. And I think some people miss the point of unemployment insurance, how much it stabilizes the economy. But I think rural Alaska probably sees that more than anybody.